salt. But no, that wasn't all. He glanced at the smiling saint again. And again, Vexilla regis inferni prodeunt. Forth come the banners of the King of Hell, whispered a memory of that perverted line from an ancient commedia. It nagged like an unwanted tune in his thought. The fist clenched tighter. He dropped the fan and breathed through his teeth. He avoided looking at the saint again. The ruthless angel ambushed him with a hot burst at his corporeal core. He leaned over the desk. That one had felt like a hot wire breaking. His hard breathing swept a clean spot in the film of desert dust on the desktop. The smell of the dust was choking. The room went pink, swarmed with black gnats.
I don't dare belch. Might shake something loose. But holy saint and patron, I've got to. Pain is ergo sum. Lord Christ God, accept this token.
He belched, tasted salt, let his head fall onto the desk.
Does the chalice have to be now, right this very minute, Lord? Or can I wait a while? But crucifixion is always now. Now, ever since before Abraham even, is always now. Before Fadentrot even, now. Always for everybody, anyhow, is to get nailed on it and then to hang on it, and if you drop off, they beat you to death with a shovel. So do it with dignity, old man. If you can belch with dignity, you may get to heaven, if you're sorry enough about messing up the rug.
He felt very apologetic. He waited a long time. Some of the gnats died, and the room lost its blush, but went hazy and gray.
Well, Paolo, are we going to hemorrhage now, or are we just going to fool around about it?
He probed the haze and found the face of the saint again. It was such a small grin, sad, understanding, and something else. Laughing at the hangman? No, laughing for the hangman. Laughing at the Stultus Maximus, at Satan himself. It was the first time he had seen it clearly. In the last chalice, there could be a chuckle of triumph.
Haec commixtio.
He was suddenly very sleepy. The saint's face grayed over, but the abbot continued to grin weakly in response. Prior Galt found him slumped over the desk shortly before noon. Blood showed between his teeth. The young priest quickly felt for a pulse. Dom Paolo awakened at once, straightened in his chair, and, as if still in a dream, he pontificated imperiously,
I tell you, it's all supremely ridiculous. It's absolutely idiotic. Nothing could be more absurd.
What's absurd, Domine?
The abbot shook his head, blinked several times.
What? I'll get Brother Andrew at once.
Oh, that's absurd. Come back here. What did you want?
Nothing, Father Abbot. I'll be back as soon as I get Brother...
Oh, bother the medic. You didn't come in here for nothing. My door was closed. Close it again. Sit down. Say what you wanted.
The test was successful. Brother Kornhauer's lamp, I mean.
All right. Let's hear about it. Sit down. Start talking. Tell me all about it.
He straightened his habit and blotted his mouth with a bit of linen. He was still dizzy, but the fist in his belly had come unclenched. He could not have cared less about the prior's account of the test, but he tried his best to appear attentive.
Got to keep him here until I'm awake enough to think. Can't let him go for the medic. Not yet. The news would get out. The old man is finished. Got to decide whether it's a safe time to be finished or not.
15. Hongan Os was essentially a just and kindly man. When he saw a party of his warriors making sport of the Loredan captives, he paused to watch. But when they tied three Loredans by their ankles between horses and whipped the horses into frenzied flight, Hongan Os decided to intervene. He ordered that the warriors be flogged on the spot, for Hongan Os, Mad Bear, was known to be a merciful chieftain. He had never mistreated a horse.
Killing captives is woman's work, he growled scornfully at the whipped culprits. Cleanse yourselves, lest you be squaw-marked. And withdraw from camp until the new moon, for you are banished 12 days.
And answering their moans of protest,
suppose the horses had dragged one of them through camp. The grass-eater chieflings are our guests, and it is known that they are easily frightened by blood, especially the blood of their own kind. Take heed.
"But these are grass-eaters from the south," a warrior objected, gesturing toward the mutilated captives. "Our guests are grass-eaters from the east. Is there not a pact between us, real people, and the east, to make war upon the south?"
"If you speak of it again, your tongue shall be cut out and fed to the dogs," Mad Bear warned. "Forget that you heard such things."
"Will the herbmen be among us for many days, O son of the mighty?"
"Who can know what the farmer things plan?" Mad Bear asked crossly. "Their thought is not as our thought. They say that some of their numbers will depart from here to pass on across the dry lands, to a place of the grass-eater priests, a place of the dark-robed ones. The others will stay here to talk, but that is not for your ears. Now go and be ashamed 12 days.
He turned his back that they might slink away without feeling his gaze pour upon them. Discipline was becoming lax of late. The clans were restless. It had become known among the people of the plains that he, Hongan Os, had clasped arms across a treaty fire with a messenger from Texarkana, and that a shaman had clipped hair and fingernails from each of them to make a good-faith doll as a defense against treachery by either party. It was known that an agreement had been made, and any agreement between people and grass-eaters was regarded by the tribes as a cause for shame. Mad Bear had felt the veiled scorn of the younger warriors, but there was no explaining to them until the right time came. Mad Bear himself was willing to listen to good thought, even if it came from a dog. The thought of grass-eaters was seldom good, but he had been impressed by the messages of the grass-eater king in the east, who had expounded the value of secrecy and deplored the idle boast. If the Loredans learned that the tribes were being armed by Hannigan, the plan would surely fail. Mad Bear had brooded on this thought. It repelled him, for certainly it was more satisfying and more manly to tell an enemy what one intended to do to him before doing it. And yet, the more he brooded on it, the more he saw its wisdom. Either the grass-eater king was a craven coward, or else he was almost as wise as a man. Mad Bear had not decided which, but he judged the thought itself as wise. Secrecy was essential, even if it seemed womanly for a time. If Mad Bear's own people knew that the arms which came to them were gifts from Hannigan, and not really the spoils of border raids, then there would arise the possibility of Laredo's learning of the scheme from captives caught on raids. It was therefore necessary to let the tribes grumble about the shame of talking peace with the farmers of the east. But the talk was not of peace. The talk was good, and it promised loot. A few weeks ago, Mad Bear himself had led a war party to the east, and had returned with 100 head of horses, 4 dozen long rifles, several kegs of black powder, ample shot, and 1 prisoner. But not even the warriors who had accompanied him knew that the cache of arms had been planted there for him by Hannigan's men, or that the prisoner was in reality a Texarkanan cavalry officer who would in the future advise Mad Bear about probable Loredan tactics during the fighting to come. All grass-eater thought was shameless, but the officer's thought could probe that of the grass-eaters to the south. It could not probe that of Hongan Os. Mad Bear was justifiably proud of himself as a bargainer. He had pledged nothing but to refrain from making war upon Texarkana and to stop stealing cattle from the eastern borders, but only as long as Hannigan furnished him with arms and supplies. The agreement to war against Laredo was an unspoken pledge of the fire, but it fitted Mad Bear's natural inclinations, and there was no need for a formal pact. Alliance with one of his enemies would permit him to deal with one foe at a time, and eventually he might regain the grazing lands that had been encroached upon and settled by the farmer people during the previous century. Night had fallen by the time the clan's chief rode into camp, and a chill had come over the plains. His guests from the east sat huddled in their blankets around the council fire with 3 of the old people, while the usual ring of curious children gaped from surrounding shadows and peeped under tent skirts at the strangers. There were 12 strangers in all, but they separated themselves into 2 distinct parties which had traveled together, but apparently cared little for each other's company. The leader of one party was obviously a madman. While Mad Bear did not object to insanity, indeed it was prized by his shamans as the most intense of supernatural visitations, he had not known that the farmers likewise regarded madness as a virtue in a leader. But this one spent half of his time digging in the earth down by the dry riverbed, and the other half jotting mysteriously in a small book, obviously a witch, and probably not to be trusted.
Mad Bear stopped only long enough to don his ceremonial wolf robes and have a shaman paint the totem mark on his forehead before he joined the group at the fire.
"Be afraid,"
an old warrior ceremonially wailed as the clan's chief stepped into the firelight.
"Be afraid, for the Mighty One walks among his children. Grovel, O clans, for his name is Mad Bear, a name well won, for as a youth he did overcome without weapons a bear run mad. With his naked hands did he strangle her, verily, in the Northlands."
Ungan Os ignored the eulogies and accepted a cup of blood from the old woman who served the council fire. It was fresh from a butchered steer and still warm. He drained it before turning to nod at the Easterners, who watched the brief wassail with apparent disquiet.
"Ah," said the clan's chief.
"Ah," replied the three old people, together with one grass-eater who dared to chime in. The people stared at the grass-eater for a moment in disgust. The insane one tried to cover his companion's blunder.
"Tell me," said the madman when the chieftain was seated, "how is it that your people drink no water? Do your gods object?"
"Who knows what the gods drink?" rumbled Mad Bear. "It is said that water is for cattle and farmers, that milk is for children, and blood for men. Should it be otherwise?"
The insane one was not insulted. He studied the chief for a moment with searching gray eyes, then nodded at one of his fellows.
"That water for the cattle explains it," he said. "The everlasting drought out here. A herdsman people would conserve what little water there is for the animals. I was wondering if they backed it by a religious taboo."
His companion grimaced and spoke in the Texarkanan tongue.
"Water? Ye gods, why can't we drink water, Thontadio? There's such a thing as too much conformity."
He spat dryly.
"Blood, blah! It sticks in the throat. Why can't we have one little sip of—"
"Not until we leave."
"But Thon—"
"No!"
snapped the scholar. Then, noticing that the clan's people were glowering at them, he spoke to Mad Bear in tongue of the plains again.
"My comrade here was speaking of the manliness and health of your people," he said. "Perhaps your diet is responsible."
"Ha!"
barked the chief, but then called almost cheerfully to the old woman.
"Give that outlander a cup of red."
Thontadio's companion shuddered, but made no protest.
"I have, O chief, a request to make of your greatness," said the scholar. "Tomorrow we shall continue our journey to the west. If some of your warriors could accompany our party, we would be honored."
"Why?"
Thontadio paused.
"Why, as guides."
He stopped and suddenly smiled.
"No, I'll be quite truthful. Some of your people disapprove of our presence here. While your hospitality has been—"
Ungan Os threw back his head and roared with laughter.
"They are afraid of the lesser clans," he said to the old ones. "They fear being ambushed as soon as they leave my tents. They eat grass and are afraid of a fight."
The scholar flushed slightly.
"Fear nothing, outlander," chortled the clan's chief. "Real men shall accompany you."
Thontadio inclined his head in mock gratitude.
"Tell us," said Mad Bear. "What is it you go to seek in the western dry land? New places for planting fields? I can tell you there are none. Except near a few water holes, nothing grows that even cattle will eat."
"We seek no new land," the visitor answered. "We are not all of us farmers, you know. We are going to look for—"
He paused. In the nomad speech, there was no way to explain the purpose of the journey to the Abbey of St. Leibowitz.
"For the skills of an ancient sorcery."
One of the old ones, a shaman, seemed to prick up his ears.
"An ancient sorcery in the west? I know of no magicians there, unless you mean the dark-robed ones."
"They are the ones."
"Ha! What magic do they have that's worth looking after? Their messengers can be captured so easily that it is no real sport, although they do endure torture well. What sorcery can you learn from them?"
"Well, for my part, I agree with you," said Thontadio. "But it is said that writings, incantations of great power, are hoarded at one of their abodes. If it is true, then obviously the dark-robed ones don't know how to use them, but we hope to master them for ourselves."
"Will the dark robes permit you to observe their secrets?"
Thontadio smiled.
I think so. They don't dare hide them any longer. We could take them if we had to.
A brave saying, scoffed Mad Bear. Evidently the farmers are braver among their own kind, although they are meek enough among real people.
The scholar, who had stomached his fill of the nomad's insults, chose to retire early. The soldiers remained at the council fire to discuss with Hongan Os the war that was certain to come. But the war, after all, was none of Thonterio's affair. The political aspirations of his ignorant cousin were far from his own interest in a revival of learning in a dark world, except when that monarch's patronage proved useful, as it already had upon several occasions.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. 16. The old hermit stood at the edge of the mesa and watched the approach of the dust speck across the desert. The hermit munched, muttered words, and chuckled silently into the wind. His withered hide was burned the color of old leather by the sun, and his brushy beard was stained yellow about the chin. He wore a basket hat and a loincloth of rough homespun that resembled burlap, his only clothing, except for sandals and a goatskin water bag. He watched the dust speck until it passed through the village of San Leibowitz, and departed again by way of the road leading past the mesa.
"Ah!" snorted the hermit, his eyes beginning to burn. "His empire shall be multiplied, and there shall be no end of his peace. He shall sit upon his kingdom."
Suddenly he went down the arroyo like a cat with three legs, using his staff, bounding from stone to stone and sliding most of the way. The dust from his rapid descent plumed high on the wind and wandered away. At the foot of the mesa, he vanished into the mesquite and settled down to wait. Soon he heard the rider approaching at a lazy trot, and he began slinking toward the road to peer out through the brush. The pony appeared from around the bend, wrapped in a thin dust shroud. The hermit darted into the trail and threw up his arms.
"Hola, ale!"
he shouted, and as the rider halted, he darted forward to seize the reins, and frown anxiously up at the man in the saddle. His eyes blazed for a moment.
"For a child is born to us, and a son is given us."
But then the anxious frown melted away into sadness.
"It's not him,"
he grumbled irritably at the sky. The rider had thrown back his hood and was laughing. The hermit blinked angrily at him for a moment. Recognition dawned.
"Oh," he grunted. "You! I thought you'd be dead by now. What are you doing out here?"
"I brought you back your prodigal, Benjamin," said Dom Paolo.
He tugged at a leash, and the blue-headed goat trotted up from behind the pony. It bleated and strained at the rope upon seeing the hermit.
"And I thought I'd pay you a visit."
"The animal is the poet's," the hermit grunted. "He won it fairly in a game of chance, although he cheated miserably. Take it back to him, and let me counsel you against meddling in worldly swindles that don't concern you. Good day."
He turned toward the arroyo.
"Wait, Benjamin. Take your goat, or I'll give it to a peasant. I won't have it wandering around the abbey and bleating into the church."
"It's not a goat," the hermit said crossly. "It's the beast which your prophet saw, and it was made for a woman to ride. I suggest you curse it and drive it into the desert. You notice, however, that it divideth the hoof and cheweth the cud."
He started away again. The abbot's smile faded.
"Benjamin, are you really going back up that hill without even a hello for an old friend?"
"Hello!"
the old Jew called back, and marched indignantly on. After a few steps, he stopped to glance over his shoulder.
"You needn't look so hurt," he said. "It's been 5 years since you've troubled to come this way, old friend. Ha!"
"So that's it,"
muttered the abbot. He dismounted and hurried after the old Jew.
"Benjamin, Benjamin, I would have come. I have not been free."
The hermit stopped.
"Well, Paolo, since you're here."
Suddenly they laughed and embraced.
"It's good, you old grump," said the hermit.
"I? A grump?
Well, I'm getting cranky, too, I guess. The last century has been a trying one for me.
I hear you've been throwing rocks at the novices who come hereabouts for their Lenten fast in the desert. Can this be true?
He eyed the hermit with mock reproof.
Only pebbles.
Miserable old pretzel.
Now, Paolo. One of them once mistook me for a distant relative of mine, name of Leibowitz. He thought I had been sent to deliver him a message, or some of your other scalawags thought so. I don't want it to happen again, so I throw pebbles at them sometimes. Ha! I'll not be mistaken for that kinsman again, for he stopped being any kin of mine.
The priest looked puzzled.
Mistook you for whom? Saint Leibowitz? Now, Benjamin, you're going too far.
Benjamin repeated it in a mocking sing-song.
Mistook me for a distant relative of mine, name of Leibowitz, so I throw pebbles at them.
Don Paolo looked thoroughly perplexed.
Saint Leibowitz has been dead for a dozen centuries. How could...
He broke off and peered warily at the old hermit.
Now, Benjamin, let's don't start that tail wagging again. You haven't lived 12 cent...
Nonsense!
Interrupted the old Jew.
I didn't say it happened 12 centuries ago. It was only 6 centuries ago, long after your saint was dead. That's why it was so preposterous. Of course, your novices were more devout in those days and more credulous. I think Francis was that one's name. Poor fellow. I buried him later. Told them in New Rome where to dig for him. That's how you got his carcass back.
The abbot gaped at the old man as they walked through the mesquite toward the waterhole, leading the horse and the goat.
Francis?
He wondered.
Francis? That could be the venerable Francis Gerard of Utah, perhaps, to whom a pilgrim had once revealed the location of the old shelter in the village. So that story went, but that was before the village was there. And about 6 centuries ago... Yes. And now this old gaffer was claiming to have been that pilgrim?
He sometimes wondered where Benjamin had picked up enough knowledge of the Abbey's history to invent such tales. From the poet, perhaps.
That was during my earlier career, of course, the old Jew went on, and perhaps such a mistake was understandable.
Earlier career?
Wanderer.
How do you expect me to believe such nonsense?
The poet believes me.
Undoubtedly. The poet certainly would never believe that the venerable Francis met a saint. That would be superstition. The poet would rather believe he met you 6 centuries ago. A purely natural explanation, eh?
Benjamin chuckled wryly. Paolo watched him lower a leaky bark cup into the well, empty it into his water skin, and lower it again for more. The water was cloudy and alive with creeping uncertainties, as was the old Jew's stream of memory. Or was his memory uncertain?
Playing games with us all?
Wondered the priest. Except for his delusion of being older than Methuselah, old Benjamin Eliezer seemed sane enough, in his own wry way.
Drink?
The hermit offered, extending the cup. The abbot suppressed a shudder, but accepted the cup so as not to offend. He drained the murky liquid at a gulp.
Not very particular, are you?
Said Benjamin, watching him critically.
Wouldn't touch it myself.
He patted the water skin.
For the animals.
The abbot gagged slightly.
You've changed, said Benjamin, still watching him. You've grown pale as cheese and wasted.
I've been ill.
You look ill. Come up to my shack, if the climb won't tire you out.
I'll be all right. I had a little trouble the other day, and our physician told me to rest. Ha! If an important guest weren't coming soon, I'd pay no attention. But he's coming, so I'm resting. It's quite tiresome.
Benjamin glanced back at him with a grin as they climbed the arroyo. He waggled his grisly head.
Riding 10 miles across the desert is resting?
For me it's rest, and I've been wanting to see you, Benjamin.
What will the villagers say?
The old Jew asked mockingly.
They'll think we've become reconciled, and that will spoil both our reputations.
Our reputations never have amounted to much in the marketplace, have they?
True,
he admitted, but added cryptically.
For the present.
Still waiting, old Jew?
Certainly,
the hermit snapped. The abbot found the climb tiring. Twice they stopped to rest. By the time they reached the tableland, he had become dizzy and was leaning on the spindly hermit for support. A dull fire burned in his chest, warning against further exertion,
but there was none of the angry clenching that had come before. A flock of the blue-headed goat mutants scattered at the approach of a stranger and fled into straggly mesquite. Oddly, the mesa seemed more verdant than the surrounding desert, although there was no visible supply of moisture.
"This way, Paolo, to my mansion."
The old Jew's hovel proved to be a single room, windowless and stone-walled, its rocks stacked loosely as a fence, with wide chinks through which the wind could blow. The roof was a flimsy patchwork of poles, most of them crooked, covered by a heap of brush, thatch, and goatskins. On a large flat rock, set on a short pillar beside the door, was a sign painted in Hebrew. The size of the sign, and its apparent attempt to advertise, led Abbot Paolo to grin and ask,
"What does it say, Benjamin? Does it attract much trade up here?"
"Ha! What should it say? It says, 'Tents mended here.'"
The priest snorted his disbelief.
"All right, doubt me. But if you don't believe what's written there, you can't be expected to believe what's written on the other side of the sign."
"Facing the wall?"
"Obviously facing the wall."
The pillar was set close to the threshold, so that only a few inches of clearance existed between the flat rock and the wall of the hovel. Paolo stooped low and squinted into the narrow space. It took him a while to make it out, but sure enough, there was something written on the back of the rock, in smaller letters.
"Do you ever turn the rock around?"
"Turn it around? You think I'm crazy? In times like these?"
"What does it say back there?"
"Hmm,"
the hermit sing-songed, refusing to answer.
"But come on in, you who can't read from the backside."
"There's a wall slightly in the way."
"There always was, wasn't there?"
The priest sighed.
"All right, Benjamin. I know what it was that you were commanded to write in the entry and on the door of your house. But only you would think of turning it face down."
"Face inward," corrected the hermit. "As long as there are tents to be mended in Israel. But let's not begin teasing each other until you've rested. I'll get you some milk. And you tell me about the visitor that's worrying you."
"There's wine in my bag, if you'd like some," said the abbot, falling with relief onto a mound of skins. "But I'd rather not talk about Thon Taddeo."
"Oh, that one."
"You've heard of Thon Taddeo? Tell me, how is it you've always managed to know everything and everybody without stirring from this hill?"
"One hears, one sees," the hermit said cryptically.
"Tell me, what do you think of him?"
"I haven't seen him, but I suppose he will be a pain. A birth pain, perhaps, but a pain."
"Birth pain? You really believe we're going to have a new renaissance, as some say?" "Stop smirking mysteriously, old Jew, and tell me your opinion. You're bound to have one. You always do. Why is your confidence so hard to get? Aren't we friends?"
On some grounds. But we have our differences, you and I."
"What have our differences got to do with Thon Taddeo and a renaissance we'd both like to see? Thon Taddeo is a secular scholar and rather remote from our differences."
Benjamin shrugged eloquently.
"Difference, secular scholars," he echoed, tossing out the words like discarded apple pits. "I have been called a secular scholar at various times by certain people, and sometimes I've been staked, stoned, and burned for it."
"Why, you never—"
The priest stopped, frowning sharply. That madness again. Benjamin was peering at him suspiciously, and his smile had gone cold.
"Now," thought the abbot, "he's looking at me as if I were one of them. Whatever formless them it was that drove him here to solitude. Staked, stoned, and burned? Or did his I mean we, as in I my people? Benjamin, I am Paolo. Torquemada is dead. I was born 70-odd years ago, and pretty soon I'll die. I have loved you, old man, and when you look at me, I wish you would see Paolo of Pecos and no other."
Benjamin wavered for a moment. His eyes became moist.
"I sometimes forget."
"And sometimes you forget that Benjamin is only Benjamin, and not all of Israel."
"Never,"
snapped the hermit, eyes blazing again.
"For 32 centuries, I—"
He stopped and closed his mouth tightly.
"Why?"
the abbot whispered, almost in awe.
Why do you take the burden of a people and its past upon yourself alone?
The hermit's eyes flared a brief warning, but he swallowed a throaty sound and lowered his face into his hands.
You fish in dark waters. Forgive me. The burden, it was pressed upon me by others.
He looked up slowly.
Should I refuse to take it?
The priest sucked in his breath. For a time there was no sound in the shanty but the sound of the wind. There was a touch of divinity in this madness, Don Paolo thought. The Jewish community was thinly scattered in these times. Benjamin had perhaps outlived his children, or somehow become an outcast. Such an old Israelite might wander for years without encountering others of his people. Perhaps in his loneliness he had acquired the silent conviction that he was the last, the one, the only, and, being the last, he ceased to be Benjamin, becoming Israel, and upon his heart had settled the history of 5,000 years, no longer remote, but become as the history of his own lifetime. His I was the converse of the imperial we.
But I, too, am a member of a oneness, thought Don Paolo, a part of a congregation and a continuity. Mine, too, have been despised by the world. Yet for me, the distinction between self and nation is clear. For you, old friend, it has somehow become obscure. A burden pressed upon you by others, and you accepted it? What must it weigh? What would it weigh for me?
He set his shoulders under it and tried to heave, testing the bulk of it.
I am a Christian monk and priest, and I am, therefore, accountable before God for the actions and deeds of every monk and priest who has breathed and walked the earth since Christ, as well as for the acts of my own.
He shuddered and began shaking his head.
No, no, it crushed the spine, this burden. It was too much for any man to bear, save Christ alone. To be cursed for a faith was burden enough. To bear the curses was possible, but then, to accept the illogic behind the curses, the illogic which called one to task not only for himself, but also for every member of his race or faith, for their actions as well as one's own, to accept that too, as Benjamin was trying to do? No, no.
And yet, Don Paolo's own faith told him that the burden was there, had been there since Adam's time, and the burden imposed by a fiend, crying in mockery, "Man!" at man. "Man!" calling each to account for the deeds of all since the beginning, a burden impressed upon every generation before the opening of the womb, the burden of the guilt of original sin. Let the fool dispute it. The same fool, with great delight, accepted the other inheritance, the inheritance of ancestral glory, virtue, triumph, and dignity, which rendered him courageous and noble by reason of birthright, without protesting that he personally had done nothing to earn that inheritance beyond being born of the race of man. The protest was reserved for the inherited burden, which rendered him guilty and outcast by reason of birthright, and against that verdict he strained to close his ears. The burden, indeed, was hard. His own faith told him, too, that the burden had been lifted from him by the one whose image hung from a cross above the altars, although the burden's imprint still was there. The imprint was an easier yoke compared to the full weight of the original curse. He could not bring himself to say it to the old man, since the old man already knew he believed it. Benjamin was looking for another, and the last old Hebrew sat alone on a mountain and did penance for Israel and waited for a Messiah, and waited, and waited, and...
God bless you for a brave fool, even a wise fool.
Wise fool, mimicked the hermit. But you always did specialize in paradox and mystery, didn't you, Paolo? If a thing can't be in contradiction to itself, then it doesn't even interest you, does it? You have to find threeness in unity, life in death, wisdom in folly. Otherwise it might make too much common sense.
To sense the responsibility is wisdom, Benjamin. To think you can carry it alone is folly.
Not madness.
A little, perhaps, but a brave madness.
Then I'll tell you a small secret. I've known all along that I can't carry it, ever since he called me forth again. But are we talking about the same thing?
The priest shrugged.
You would call it the burden of being chosen. I would call it the burden of original guilt. In either case, the implied responsibility is the same, although we might tell different versions of it, and disagree violently in words about what we mean in words by something that isn't really meant in words at all, since it's something that's meant in the dead silence of a heart.
Benjamin chuckled.
Well, I'm glad to hear you admit it, finally, even if all you say is that you've never really said anything.
Stop cackling, you reprobate.
But you've always used words so wordily in crafty defense of your Trinity, although he never needed such defense before you got him from me as a unity. Eh?
The priest reddened, but said nothing.
There!
Benjamin yelped, bouncing up and down.
I made you want to argue for once. Ha! But never mind. I use quite a few words myself, but I'm never quite sure he and I mean the same thing either. I suppose you can't be blamed. It must be more confusing with three than with one.
Blasphemous old cactus! I really wanted your opinion of Thontadio and whatever's brewing.
Why seek the opinion of a poor old anchorite?
Because, Benjamin Eleazar Bar Joshua, if all these years of waiting for one who isn't coming haven't taught you wisdom, at least they've made you shrewd.
The old Jew closed his eyes, lifted his face ceilingward, and smiled cunningly.
Insult me, he said in mocking tones. Rail at me, bait me, persecute me. But do you know what I'll say?
You'll say,
No. I'll say he's already here. I caught a glimpse of him once.
What? Who are you talking about? Thontadio?
No. Moreover, I do not care to prophesy. Unless you tell me what's really bothering you, Paolo.
Well, it all started with Brother Kornhauer's lamp.
Lamp? Oh, yes, the poet mentioned it. He prophesied it wouldn't work.
The poet was wrong, as usual. So they tell me. I didn't watch the trial.
It worked, then. Splendid. And that started what?
Me wondering, how close are we to the brink of something, or how close to a shore? Electrical essences in the basement. Do you realize how much things have changed in the past 2 centuries?
Soon, the priest spoke at length of his fears, while the hermit, mender of tents, listened patiently until the sun had begun to leak through the chinks in the west wall to paint glowing shafts in the dusty air.
Since the death of the last civilization, the memorabilia has been our special province, Benjamin, and we've kept it. But now, I sense the predicament of the shoemaker who tries to sell shoes in a village of shoemakers.
The hermit smiled.
It could be done, if he manufactures a special and superior type of shoe.
I'm afraid the secular scholars are already beginning to lay claim to such a method.
Then go out of the shoemaking business, before you are ruined.
A possibility, the abbot admitted. It's unpleasant to think of it, however. For 12 centuries, we've been one little island in a very dark ocean. Keeping the memorabilia has been a thankless task, but a hallowed one, we think. It's only our worldly job, but we've always been bookleggers and memorizers, and it's hard to think that the job's soon to be finished, soon to become unnecessary. I can't believe that somehow.
So you try to best the other shoemakers by building strange contraptions in your basement?
I must admit, it looks that way.
What will you do next to keep ahead of the seculars? Build a flying machine? Or revive the Machina Analytica? Or perhaps step over their heads and resort to metaphysics?
You shame me, old Jew. You know we are monks of Christ first, and such things are for others to do.
I wasn't shaming you. I see nothing inconsistent in monks of Christ building a flying machine, although it would be more like them to build a praying machine.
Wretch, I do my order a disservice by sharing a confidence with you.
Benjamin smirked.
I have no sympathy for you. The books you stored away may be hoary with age, but they were written by children of the world, and they'll be taken from you by children of the world, and you had no business meddling with them in the first place.
Ah, now you care to prophesy.
Not at all.
Soon the sun will set. Is that prophecy? No, it's merely an assertion of faith in the consistency of events. The children of the world are consistent, too. So I say they will soak up everything you can offer, take your job away from you, and then denounce you as a decrepit wreck. Finally, they'll ignore you entirely. It's your own fault. The book I gave you should have been enough for you. Now you'll just have to take the consequences for your meddling.
He had spoken flippantly, but his prediction seemed uncomfortably close to Don Paolo's fears. The priest's countenance saddened.
Pay me no mind, said the hermit. I'll not venture to soothsay before I've seen this contraption of yours, or taken a look at this Don Tatio, who begins to interest me, by the way. Wait until I've examined the entrails of the new era in better detail, if you expect advice from me.
Well, you won't see the lamp, because you never come to the abbey.
It's your abominable cooking I object to.
And you won't see Don Tatio, because he comes from the other direction. If you wait to examine the entrails of an era until after it's born, it's too late to prophesy its birth.
Nonsense! Probing the womb of the future is bad for the child. I shall wait, and then I shall prophesy that it was born and that it wasn't what I'm waiting for.
What a cheerful outlook! So, what are you looking for?
Someone who shouted at me once.
Shouted?
Come forth!
What rot!
Hm-hm! To tell you the truth, I don't much expect him to come, but I was told to wait, and—
He shrugged.
I wait.
After a moment, his twinkling eyes narrowed to slits, and he leaned forward with sudden eagerness.
Paolo, bring this Don Tatio past the foot of the mesa.
The abbot recoiled in mock horror.
Accoster of pilgrims, molester of novices, I shall send you the poet Sirrah, and may he descend upon you and rest forever. Bring the thorn past your lair? What an outrage!
Benjamin shrugged again.
Very well, forget that I asked it. But let's hope this thorn will be on our side and not with the others this time.
Others, Benjamin?
Manassas, Cyrus, Nebuchadrezzar, Pharaoh, Caesar, Hannigan II. Need I go on? Samuel warned us against them, then gave us one. When they have a few wise men shackled nearby to counsel them, they become more dangerous than ever. That's all the advice I'll give you.
Well, Benjamin, I've had enough of you now to last me another 5 years, so—
Insult me! Rail at me! Bait me!
Stop it. I'm leaving, old man. It's late.
So? And how is the ecclesiastical belly fixed for the ride?
My stomach?
Don Paolo paused to explore, found himself more comfortable than at any time in recent weeks.
It's a mess, of course, he complained. How else would it be after listening to you?
True. El Shaddai is merciful, but he is also just.
Godspeed, old man. After Brother Kornhauer reinvents the flying machine, I'll send up some novices to drop rocks on you.
They embraced affectionately. The old Jew led him to the edge of the mesa. Benjamin stood wrapped in a prayer shawl, its fine fabric contrasting oddly with the rough burlap of his loincloth, while the abbot climbed down to the trail and rode back toward the abbey. Don Paolo could still see him standing there at sundown, his spindly figure silhouetted against the twilight sky as he bowed and munched a prayer over the desert.
"Memento, Domine, omnium famulorum tuorum,"
the abbot whispered in response, adding,
"And may he finally win the poet's eyeball at Mumbly Peg. Amen."
17. "I can tell you definitely there will be war," said the messenger from New Rome. "All Laredo's forces are committed to the plains. Mad Bear has broken camp. There's a running cavalry battle, nomad style, all over the plains. But the state of Chihuahua is threatening Laredo from the south, so Hannigan is getting ready to send Texarkana forces to the Rio Grande to help defend the frontier, with the Laredans' full approval, of course."
"King Garaldi is a doddering fool," said Don Paolo. "Wasn't he warned against Hannigan's treachery?"
The messenger smiled. "The Vatican diplomatic service always respects state secrets, if we happen to learn them, Lest we be accused of espionage, we are always careful about,
"Was he warned?"
the abbot demanded again. Of course. Giraldi said the papal legate was lying to him. He accused the church of fomenting dissension among the allies of the Holy Scourge, in an attempt to promote the pope's temporal power. The idiot even told Hannigan about the legate's warning. Don Paolo winced and whistled.
So Hannigan did what?
The messenger hesitated. I suppose I can tell you. Monsignor Apollo is under arrest. Hannigan ordered his diplomatic files seized. There's talk in New Rome of placing the whole realm of Texarkana under interdict. Of course, Hannigan has already incurred ipso facto excommunication, but that doesn't seem to bother many Texarkanans. As you surely know, the population is about 80% cultist anyhow, and the Catholicism of the ruling class has always been a thin veneer.
So now, Marcus,
the abbot murmured sadly.
And what of Don Taddeo?
I don't quite see how he expects to get across the plains without picking up a few musket ball holes just now. It seems clear why he hadn't wanted to make the trip, but I know nothing about his progress, Father Abbot. Don Paolo's frown was pained.
If our refusal to send the material to his university leads to his being killed...
Don't trouble your conscience about that, Father Abbot. Hannigan looks out for his own. I don't know how, but I'm sure the Thon will get here.
The world could ill afford to lose him, I hear. Well, but tell me, why were you sent to report Hannigan's plans to us? We're in the Empire of Denver, and I can't see how this region is affected.
Ah, but I've told you only the beginning. Hannigan hopes to unite the continent eventually. After Laredo's firmly leashed, he will have broken the encirclement that's kept him in check. Then the next move will be against Denver.
But wouldn't that involve supply lines across nomad country? It seems impossible.
It's extremely difficult, and that's what makes the next move certain. The plains form a natural geographical barrier. If they were depopulated, Hannigan might regard his western frontier as secure, as it stands. But the nomads have made it necessary for all states adjoining the plains to tie up permanent military forces around the nomad territory for containment. The only way to subdue the plains is to control both fertile strips, to the east and to the west.
But even so, the abbot wondered, the nomads...
Hannigan's plan for them is devilish. Mad Bear's warriors can easily cope with Laredo's cavalry, but what they can't cope with is a cattle plague. The plains tribes don't know it yet, but when Laredo set out to punish the nomads for border raiding, the Laredans drove several hundred head of diseased cattle ahead to mingle with the nomads' herds. It was Hannigan's idea. The result will be famine, and then it will be easy to set tribe against tribe. We don't, of course, know all the details, but the goal is a nomad legion under a puppet chieftain, armed by Texarkana, loyal to Hannigan, ready to sweep west to the mountains. If it comes to pass, this region will get the first breakers.
But why? Surely Hannigan doesn't expect the barbarians to be dependable troops, or capable of holding an empire once they finish mutilating it.
No, my lord. But the nomad tribes will be disrupted. Denver will be shattered. Then Hannigan can pick up the pieces.
To do what with them? It couldn't be a very rich empire.
No, but secure on all flanks. He might then be in a better position to strike east or northeast. Of course, before it comes to that, his plans may collapse. But whether they collapse or not, this region may well be in danger of being overrun in the not-too-distant future. Steps should be taken to secure the abbey within the next few months. I have instructions to discuss with you the problem of keeping the memorabilia safe. Don Paolo felt the blackness beginning to gather. After 12 centuries, a little hope had come into the world. And then came an illiterate prince to ride roughshod over it with a barbarian horde, and his fist exploded onto the desktop.
"We kept them outside our walls for 1,000 years, he growled, "and we can keep them out for another 1,000. This abbey was under siege 3 times during the Bayring influx, and once again during the Vazarianist schism. We'll keep the books safe. We've kept them that way for quite some time."
But there is an added hazard these days, my lord.
What may that be?
A bountiful supply of gunpowder and grapeshot. The Feast of the Assumption had come and gone, but still there was no word of the party from Texarkana. private votive masses for pilgrims and travelers were beginning to be offered by the abbey's priests. Dom Paolo had ceased taking even a light breakfast, and it was whispered that he was doing penance for having invited the scholar at all, in view of the present danger on the plains. The watchtowers remained constantly manned. The abbot himself frequently climbed the wall to peer eastward. Shortly before Vespers, on the feast of St. Bernard, a novice reported seeing a thin and distant dust trail, but darkness was coming on, and no one else had been able to make it out. Soon, Compline and the Salve Regina were sung, but still no one appeared at the gates.
"It might have been their advance scout," suggested Prior Galt.
"It might have been Brother Watchman's imagination," countered Dom Paolo.
"But if they've camped just 10 miles or so down the way,
we'd see their fire from the tower. It's a clear night.
Still, Domne, after the moon rises, we could send a rider—"
"Oh, no. That's a good way to get shot by mistake. If it's really them, they probably kept their fingers on their triggers for the whole trip, especially at night. It can wait until dawn."
It was late the following morning when the expected party of horsemen appeared out of the east. From the top of the wall, Dom Paolo blinked and squinted across the hot and dry terrain, trying to focus myopic eyes on the distance. Dust from the horses' hooves was drifting away to the north. The party had stopped for a parley.
"I seem to be seeing 20 or 30 of them,"
the abbot complained, rubbing his eyes in annoyance.
"Are there really so many?"
"Approximately," said Galt.
"How will we ever take care of them all?"
"I don't think we'll be taking care of the ones with the wolfskins, my lord abbot,"
the younger priest said stiffly.
"Wolfskins?"
"Nomads, my lord."
"Man the walls! Close the gates! Get down the shield! Break out the—"
"Wait, they're not all nomads, Domne."
"Oh?"
Dom Paolo turned to peer again. The parley was being ended. Men waved. The group split in two. The larger party galloped back toward the east. The remaining horsemen watched briefly, then reined around and trotted toward the abbey.
6 or 7 of them, some in uniform," the abbot murmured as they drew closer.
"The Thon and his party, I'm sure."
"But with nomads? It's a good thing I didn't let you send a rider out last night. What were they doing with nomads?"
"It appeared that they came as guides," Father Galt said darkly.
"How neighborly of the lion to lie down with the lamb."
The riders approached the gates. Dom Paolo swallowed dryness.
"Well, we'd better go welcome them, Father," he sighed.
By the time the priests had descended from the wall, the travelers had reined up just outside the courtyard. A horseman detached himself from the others, trotted forward, dismounted, and presented his papers.
"Dom Paolo of Pecos, Abbas?"
The abbot bowed.
"Tibiadsum. Welcome in the name of St. Libowitz, Thontadio. Welcome in the name of his abbey, in the name of 40 generations who've waited for you to come. Be at home. We serve you."
The words were heartfelt. The words had been saved for many years while awaiting this moment. Hearing a muttered monosyllable in reply, Dom Paolo looked up slowly. For a moment, his glance locked with the scholar's. He felt the warmth quickly fade. Those icy eyes, cold and searching gray, skeptical, hungry, and proud. They studied him as one might study a lifeless curio. That this moment might be as a bridge across a gulf of 12 centuries, Paolo had fervently prayed. Prayed, too, that through him the last martyred scientist of that earlier age would clasp hands with tomorrow. There was indeed a gulf, that much was plain. The abbot felt suddenly that he belonged not to this age at all, that he had been left stranded somewhere on a sandbar in Time's river, and that there wasn't really ever a bridge at all.
"Come," he said gently. "Brother Visclair will attend to your horses."
When he had seen the guests installed in their lodgings, and had retired to the privacy of his study, the smile on the face of the wooden saint reminded him unaccountably of the smirk of old Benjamin Eleazar, saying,
"The children of this world are consistent, too."
18.
"Now, even as in the time of Job," Brother Reader began from the refectory lectern, "when the sons of God came to stand before the Lord, Satan also was present among them.
And the Lord said to him, Whence comest thou, Satan? And Satan answering said, As of old, I have gone round about the earth, and have walked through it. And the Lord said to him, Hast thou considered that simple and upright prince, my servant Name, hating evil and loving peace? And Satan answering said, Doth Name fear God in vain? For hast thou not blessed his hand with great wealth, and made him mighty among nations? But stretch forth thy hand a little, and decrease what he hath, and let his enemy be strengthened. Then see if he blasphemeth thee not to thy face. And the Lord said to Satan, Behold what he hath, and lessen it. See thou to it. And Satan went forth from the presence of God, and returned into the world. Now the prince Name was not as holy Job, for when his land was afflicted with trouble, and his people less rich than before, when he saw his enemy become mightier, he grew fearful, and ceased to trust in God, thinking unto himself, I must strike before the enemy overwhelmeth me, without taking his sword in hand. And so it was in those days, said Brother Reader, that the princes of earth had hardened their hearts against the law of the Lord, and of their pride there was no end. And each of them thought within himself that it was better for all to be destroyed than for the will of other princes to prevail over his. For the mighty of the earth did contend among themselves for supreme power over all. By stealth, treachery, and deceit they did seek to rule, and of war they feared greatly and did tremble. For the Lord God had suffered the wise men of those times to learn the means by which the world itself might be destroyed, and into their hands was given the sword of the archangel wherewith Lucifer had been cast down, that men and princes might fear God and humble themselves before the Most High. But they were not humbled. And Satan spoke unto a certain prince, saying, Fear not to use the sword, for the wise men have deceived you in saying that the world would be destroyed thereby. Listen not to the counsel of weaklings, for they fear you exceedingly, and they serve your enemies by staying your hand against them. Strike, and know that you shall be king over all. And the prince did heed the word of Satan, and he summoned all of the wise men of that realm, and called upon them to give him counsel as to the ways in which the enemy might be destroyed without bringing down the wrath upon his own kingdom. But most of the wise men said, Lord, it is not possible, for your enemies also have the sword which we have given you, and the fieriness of it is as the flame of hell, and as the fury of the sun-star from whence it was kindled. Then thou shalt make me yet another, which is yet 7 times hotter than hell itself, commanded the prince, whose arrogance had come to surpass that of Pharaoh. And many of them said, Nay, Lord, ask not this thing of us, for even the smoke of such a fire, if we were to kindle it for thee, would cause many to perish. Now the prince was angry because of their answer, and he suspected them of betraying him, and he sent his spies among them to tempt them and to challenge them. Whereupon the wise men became afraid. Some among them changed their answers, that his wrath be not invoked against them. 3 times he asked them, and 3 times they answered, Nay, Lord, even your own people will perish if you do this thing. But one of the magi was like unto Judas Iscariot, and his testimony was crafty, and having betrayed his brothers, he lied to all the people, advising them not to fear the demon fallout. The prince heeded this false wise man, whose name was Blackeneth, and he caused spies to accuse many of the magi before the people. Being afraid, the less wise among the magi counseled the prince according to his pleasure, saying, The weapons may be used, only do not exceed such and such a limit, or all will surely perish. And the prince smote the cities of his enemies with the new fire, and for 3 more days and nights did his great catapults and metal birds rain wrath upon them. Over each city a sun appeared, and was brighter than the sun of heaven, and immediately that city withered, and melted as wax under the torch, and the people thereof did stop in the streets, and their skins smoked, and they became as faggots thrown on the coals. And when the fury of the sun had faded, the city was in flames,
and a great thunder came out of the sky, like the great battering ram Picadon, to crush it utterly. Poisonous fumes fell over all the land,